My name is Jody Kretzman, and I have just come to Holden this summer on teaching staff, although I've been here probably half a dozen times over the last dozen years and always enjoyed the opportunity to raise questions and have discussions with people at Holden. It's different from my usual scene, and since I will be partly sharing a few biases in an informal way with you this evening, you might as well know a little bit about my own setting and the craziness that I normally run around in, which has made me somewhat crazy also. I live in Chicago, and in a sort of incomprehensible next phrase for most of the people I run into at Holden, I love Chicago. I absolutely adore the city. I think it's a terrific place to be. I wouldn't want to be in and work in and live in any other place in the country, unless maybe it's the South Bronx. So for me, Holden is a real change, and I've come to appreciate the contrast in my life. So has my family, my spouse and partner Ingrid, and our two kids. Also, particularly for kids, life at Holden is a little bit different. We have to keep them on fairly short leashes in Chicago. We live in the city, and it's a marvelous place to live, and there are lots of opportunities for kids, and kids get street smart pretty quick, but still, when they're 7 and 11, you don't want them to go too far. And the freedom that comes with having a whole village looking after each other's children is just marvelous out here. Ingrid and I in Chicago not only live there and love it, but we treat the city as our subject matter. I direct an urban studies program for a group of Midwestern colleges, and we welcome your sons and daughters, students from St. Olaf and Carleton and McAllister, places like that, to Chicago for a semester at a time, and try to do the city with them in all of the city's variety and in all of the city's challenging realities. It's a different kind of setting in which to teach, but that too has shaped my own perceptions of where we are. And I think the last thing I need to tell you about myself is that I do take questions of public policy discussion and public policy formation seriously in my life on a number of different levels, both academic and in my research and writing chores, but I think much more importantly as an actor in the public policy arena, particularly for the last 5 years. I've served on a variety of policy advisory capacities for the current mayor of Chicago, Harold Washington, and recently chaired his policy committee for his reelection campaign. And since he's going to be around, in fact, for another 4 years, we'll be continuing that work with City Hall during that time. So my perspective on what's going on in the United States, I'm telling you, is shaped in very major ways by my experience in Chicago. I see the United States through the eyes of a city of 3 million people, of a city of immense cultural and ethnic and racial diversity, a city of incredible contrasts between rich and poor, a city now governed in its public sector by people of color, by a black administration. Now, all of that, I think, is a little bit different from most of the settings that people bring with them to Holden. But there are lots of varieties in those settings, and part of the fun of discussing public policy questions and issues here at Holden is the variety of different perspectives that people bring to those discussions. So I want to make sure that we leave plenty of time in the sessions I'll be doing this week, next week, and the week after for discussion and sharing of a variety of views. I thought that I would do a series of things this week, this being the first one, under the general rubric, Facing the Forgotten Frontier. And I think that the title probably deserves a slight explanation. I have two things in mind, really, with the phrase Forgotten Frontier. One of them is, in fact, the city, which is the concrete place where I mess around and have my being and where I, in fact, enjoy myself, but through the lenses of which I view reality. The city, I think, is a forgotten frontier. It had its moment in the sun in terms of public consciousness in the United States, probably from about 1965 and the Voting Rights Act and the War on Poverty through about 1974 and 1973, the beginnings of Watergate probably was the beginning of the end for public consciousness, including non-urban Americans, right, of what cities were about. Cities on the front burner of the public policy agenda. Sort of peaked in those 8 years. Whatever the reasons were for the unpeaking of that interest, those reasons did not include the fact that the problems identified in cities and the challenges presented by cities were solved. They weren't. The country got up, left the table, and went someplace else for a while. Cities are still there. They are now forgotten. I'm arguing that cities, though, are not just forgotten, but that in fact they are a frontier. A city like my own Chicago, it seems to me, is a frontier in a number of different ways. But the most challenging of those ways is that if Chicago doesn't make it, my argument is, the United States won't. Chicago is a place which is more like the rest of the globe than most parts of the United States. After all, in a total global context, white Europeans make up about 11% of the population of the earth. The global challenge of the next 50 years is to figure out how different cultures, different races, very different experiences, and very different relations to the economic systems, which are increasingly global, how all of those things will get worked out. The crucible for figuring out what to do about that next 50 or 100 years on the global level, the crucible for the United States for figuring that out is the United States city. It's the city where the mix of this stuff all comes together. So in that sense, I'm saying if we're interested in the frontier challenge of the next century, we ought to reinterest ourselves in cities, in American cities in particular, because unlike cities in the rest of the world, American cities bring all elements of the globe together. And that's one of the things that makes them unique and exciting. So I'm saying cities are forgotten. Yes, they shouldn't be. One of the reasons they shouldn't be is that they are a frontier that leads us, in many ways, I think, into the 21st century. But I want to think about facing a forgotten frontier in a second sense. Because I know that there is not a direct interest on the part of many of you in what's happening in even so fascinating a city as Chicago, or in urban reality in general. I know that cities are a forgotten reality in lots of ways. I want to use the experience of thinking about cities as a way to open up the discussion of public policy issues that extend far beyond cities. I'm saying that the second forgotten frontier is, and I'm certainly not the only one to be saying this these days, is in fact the kingdom or queendom or realm of public discussion that we have forgotten as a people in the United States how it is that acting as a public and discussing our future together, even in constituting ways in this 200th anniversary year of the Constitution, we have forgotten how to do that. We are out of practice about that. One of the best books of the last quarter century, it seems to me, that examines the American character and part of the American dilemma that I'm interested in this evening is, of course, Habits of the Heart by Bob Bella and his cohorts down at the University of California. And his argument is precisely that the whole structure of our lives and the economic base that underlies that structure has been a privatizing force, that we are increasingly governed by a view of the world which is personalistic, encapsulating, individuating, that our realities are person-to-person kinds of realities, and that we have lost the capacity as people to think of about ourselves as a people, as a public, as a community. And there are all kinds of reasons for that. Those of you who haven't read The Habits of the Heart, I certainly highly recommend it. It was taught I think it concentrated on a lot during winter community at Holden, and lots of people, I think, enjoyed it. Lots of other people, including some very conservative commentators, are arguing the same kind of point, though, that that there is a forgotten frontier of public discussion. So it's those two ways in which I'm thinking about facing a forgotten frontier here. One is the American city, but the American city as a way of opening up the larger issues that seem to me to be reconstituting themselves for us as we head into the next century. The art of public discussion and debate. And what better place than Holden, really, to reopen and repractice and push each other to rediscover our peoplehood and the ability to deal with the public agenda. Okay. I'll talk about a number of different things under that rubric, facing the forgotten frontier, in this session and some following sessions. This evening, though, I want to open up a discussion which is really going to be in very outlined form, because I want to have some time for some feedback and some commentary by you. Centered on what seemed to me to be some dilemmas of the contemporary American economy. And I don't want to make this an economics lecture. I want to outline for you some of, not in economics 101 terms even, not in economists' terms, but in a broader sort of citizen terminology, what it seems to me some of the major impacts of our current economic direction are, and see if we can think our way through what those impacts mean for us and what directions we might need to go because of them. I have hopelessness in my title tonight, and I think that I put it there not simply to invite everybody into a downer, but to be honest, when I think about the variety of directions in which the American economy at this point is presenting us with problems, I tend to get, and when I think about those all at once, which I want to do for a few minutes tonight, I tend to get, my own state of mind tends to get hopeless. It seems to me to be overwhelming, the set of dilemmas that we're presented with at this point. So partly the hopelessness is a reflection of my own state of mind, which perhaps and hopefully you may not share. But I think I want to have hopelessness in my title tonight because it, more importantly, refers to the state of mind and the state of being of millions of Americans who find themselves at the, not even the bottom end of this economy, but what I want to argue with you tonight, they find themselves disconnected entirely from the ongoing functioning of the American economy. And that is a hopeless state of affairs for them, not just for me. Later in the week, I'm going to do some more hopeful stuff, at least stuff that I think presents us with more signs of hope in my own realm, in cities, and in public policy in general. I want to share some hopes on Thursday, I think, involving the incredibly world-leading, ethically rich, diverse cultural reality that is the United States in the wonderful quilt that we are. I want to talk about races and cultures and their complex interaction a little bit and the hope that's in that on Thursday. And then later on in the week, I want to talk about hope in relationship to size, hope in relationship to scale, hope in relationship to the size of our world, right? What it is we can affect and what not. Lots of people at Holden are expert at thinking about that last set of questions, so that'll be fun too. Today, though, briefly, the dilemmas of the American economy, and again, let me apologize for any economists in the room because I'm not going to do an economics lecture. I want to basically talk about four dilemmas. A dilemma is a box. A dilemma is a set of circumstances which defines a reality out of which there seems to be no way, right? And these problems seem to me often to be more than problems, and they are dilemmas in this, in the sense that I just described. I do think it's important for us as Christians and as citizens to think them through, to try to understand them, and to try to affect as citizens the ethical fabric in which we work. The major backdrop for what I want to say briefly is one that you all know about. It is the major structural shift in the American economy that has accelerated over the last quarter of a century. And the effects of this major structural shift we're just now beginning, I think, beginning to understand. It's the shift from an industrial economy to what's most safely called a post-industrial economy. You can call it post-industrial, and therefore you don't have to say what it is. You can just say what it isn't. But a lot of people call it a service-centered economy. Now, this is not just an academic exercise thinking about this. I want to say that every one of our lives has been affected over the last quarter of a century by this massive structural shift in the economy. It's hard, I know, for Americans and for Protestant Americans, I think in particular, to think about institutions and structures, because they're not, they don't, you know, don't really have human faces on them. We think about humans being the major actors in all of these things, and in fact they are. But I want to talk about structures tonight. Bear with me a little bit. I want to talk about this major shift from industrial to post-industrial or service-centered economy as I've seen it concretely happen in my city and in other cities, and then open it to the rest of the country as well. American cities really have gone through three major structural times in their economic life, and we're now in the third, okay? Most Eastern and Midwestern cities, you all know this, all Westerners came at some point, right, in your ancestry from the great Midwest or East. But American cities, like the cities of Europe, in fact, grew up as centers of trade, centers of merchandising, mercantile centers, often, at least in the case of mid-American cities, centers of trading that had agriculture at its base, right? Sometime then, in the mid to late 19th century, overlaid on all those ports and on all that transportation stuff, overlaid on all of that, bam, came the Industrial Revolution. And all of a sudden, you have all of the older Eastern and Midwestern cities and good parts of the Western cities laid out to serve industry, right? The great icon of the late 19th, early 20th century city developer was the clock. Once you had city life organized around a clock so that people thought of themselves and their lives as things to be plugged into a 24-hour day, not a natural thought, although at Holden we certainly think about the clock a lot. Once you had people trained to do that, you had people trained to fit into an industrial process of an economy, okay? So you had textiles in the Northeast, and you had steel later in the Midwest, and you had foodstuffs everywhere, and a variety of woods and lumber-related stuff in the West, all making things. What's happened now in the last quarter century? Where are we now? We've moved into something called a post-industrial city. Naturally, what's happened is that this follows on the decline of the industrial city for the last 25 years. Massive changes, technological and organizational, have shifted the way people do work, the way people create wealth. Fewer people in many industries can produce more goods. That's true in many industries. In other industries, where particularly lower skilled workers were needed, the operations have become entirely mobile. That is, they can be shipped out to the South or to third world countries, to low-wage non-union parts of the globe. So industry has become mobile, and industry has discarded people. This is called the deindustrialization of American cities, and in fact the deindustrialization of the United States. And it's, I'm saying this, it is the significant economic shift of the last 25 years. But cities, like lots of other parts of the United States, but cities you can really see it, are dynamic places. They're always changing. Shifts happen constantly. So a new kind of economic life grew up as the industry left and declined. The new kind of economic life is symbolized by the massive towers in downtown Seattle, in downtown Minneapolis, in downtown Chicago, in fact, in downtowns across the country, all over the place. Have you noticed the new gleaming downtowns of the big cities all across the country? What's going on there? One of the things that's going on there is that a whole new kind of economic activity has replaced the older industrial activity. Did you ever ask yourself, some of you may even have worked in these, what is it that happens in these buildings, in those places? What happens in those 102-story buildings in downtown Chicago? Kit, you've worked there, right? I can tell you one thing that doesn't happen. Nobody in those buildings ever makes a thing, right? Nothing is produced. No new wealth is created in any of those buildings. 500,000 people commute into the central city of Chicago, into the Loop, every day, and then leave it. And not one of those 500,000 people makes anything. Right. What do they do if they're not making stuff?
Punch computers.
They do punch computers, that's right. They create and push information, right, mostly, and process a variety of transactions that are not taking place there, are taking place elsewhere. So those new downtowns, it seems to me, can be understood by thinking about a sort of triple C. They are centers of command, and they are centers of control, and they are centers of communication. Right? What happens in those big buildings is that people figure out the commands for the global economy. Right? The higher up in those buildings you go, the more territory is covered by the decisions that are made on that floor. Right? The command decisions emanate from the top floors most often. Once the command decisions are made for an increasingly global and interconnected economy, the control decisions get made. That is, how do you implement what the command decisions have been? Right? How do you get the sets of commands out to 500, 1,000 different spots where the new global corporation has its operations? You employ then the people on the lower floors as the communications experts, as the people to send along the control mechanisms emanating from the command decisions. So command, control, and communication is what's going on in those big skyscrapers. What does that mean for the people in those skyscrapers? Who are they now? I think that they're different people than they used to be in American cities. I think they need to know more. There are jobs down there in information, in administration, in technology. Skills for those jobs are skills that nobody had 25 years ago. So the new sparkling downtowns in Chicago and Manhattan and Seattle and San Francisco and Boston and even places like Cleveland and Detroit are reflections of a totally new way of doing work. That's what I'm saying here. Okay? Right next to those new downtowns, we have an equally new set of developments. That is the rise of an intractably, increasingly looks like permanent group of people who are locked in to poverty in ways that I'm arguing we've never seen before. New sparkling downtowns developing at the same time, and I'm arguing not coincidentally, to at the same time as as underclass neighborhoods. Neighborhoods where there are literally no jobs left. Neighborhoods where, in fact, there is no connection to the mainstream economy. Neighborhoods where, because all of the systems have failed, there's no way for people to move into those jobs that are being created in the downtowns. Neighborhoods that might as well be on a different planet from the downtowns of the cities that they occupy. A major mismatch between the development of the jobs that this economy needs and the development of the people to fill those jobs is creating what looks more and more like a permanent underclass, right? Doesn't have a whole lot to do with race. Doesn't have a whole lot to do with ambition. Doesn't have a whole lot to do with sets of values. All of these things are important, and if you're working in those communities, you work with those things all the time. But when you step back from it, what has happened is that the way in which my ancestors and your ancestors, who are white, came to this country, those who came to cities, stepped on the bottom rung of a ladder. Stepped on the bottom rung of a ladder that had another rung, and another rung, and another rung. That bottom rung didn't require much in the way of education, didn't require much in the way of skill. All it required was a willingness to work and sometimes a strong back, right? That bottom rung is what has been absolutely eliminated from the ladder, which is our economy, in cities today. So if today you find yourself poor and not well educated, there is no bottom rung on which you can begin your ascent into the American economy. That's the structural explanation for growing poverty in the United States. And it's why I am more worried about poverty today in the United States than I have ever been in my years of thinking about public policy questions. I'm not sure anymore how it is that you reconstruct the bottom rung of the ladder. I'm just not sure. I think we're beginning to see some effects of this problem in the economy, this creation of a new poverty, particularly in the 1980s. You can see some of it. I've just got a couple of things down here. There are lots of ways you can look at this, but here are a couple of things that have just struck me recently. As recently as 1970, 33% of the jobs, and they really were important to American cities, were sort of the engines of the economy. 33%, a third of the jobs were in manufacturing. By 1985, it was 23% in manufacturing. So a 10% drop in the percentage of jobs in manufacturing in just 15 years. Total employment, up 8% in the last 5 years. Non-service sector employment, that is manufacturing and industrial employment, down 2%. What's this mean for people? Average manufacturing wages in industry, even though that's flattened out over the last 15 years, is something like $373 a week if you're working in industry. Average wages in non-manufacturing, depending on the sector, is somewhere between $176 and $240 a week. So even for those people who get into the economy, they're getting in non-manufacturing service sector jobs that pay less and perhaps demand less of folks. So although something like 9 million new jobs have been created since 1979 by the American economy, over half of them pay under $7,000 a year. Over half of the new jobs created pay under $7,000 a year. So that you're getting not only a locked out, unemployed, increasingly concentrated and cut off set of poor people, but you're also getting a set, I'm arguing now, of working poor who are tied into service sector jobs that are very low paying, many of them part-time. Lots of indicators of the regrowth of poverty after about 10 or 15 years of some progress. 1959, something like 40 million poor people. You know, there are lots of different ways to define that, but using fairly consistent measures with constant dollars, something like 40 million poor people, down to 29 million poor by 1980, with a couple of decades of fairly concentrated, particularly public policy efforts. But by 1985, an additional 5 million poor people, back up from 29 million to 34 million poor people by 1985 in the United States. And even more alarmingly, I think over now 20% of American children are born into poverty, which compares to the kind of percentage we were looking at in 1959 before any poverty programs as well. One other set of things to think about: the income gap, the gap between rich and poor, has also begun to re-widen again after some decades of some slight progress in closing it. One way to think about it: for the poorest 40% in the last 5 years, for the poorest 40% of the population, their income has dropped $236 on the average. For the wealthiest 40%, right, their income has risen by about $2,195, and for percent it's up $7,000. So that the gap between, again including the working poor here, the gap between rich and poor, which is, some argue, one measure of sort of the civilized, the level of civilization of the working of an economy, that seems to have gotten worse in the 1980s. And I really, at this point, don't mean to point a finger at the Reagan administration. I think a lot of this is, in fact, structural and due to what's happening to our economy. I don't happen to think myself that the current administration has dealt with that very well, but I do think that they probably haven't caused it. Let me now just, I could say a lot more about that. I want to say very quickly three other things and then open it up for some questions. I think there are some other items on the list of things to be worried about caused by this structural shift to a post-industrial economy. And it may be that these things are, since a lot of you may not be in immediate frontline city situations, it may be some of these things that you might want to talk about. It does seem to me that there's there is clearly connected with the globalization of the economy, a devaluation of place and what I'm calling a promotion of rootlessness. I mean that in a whole lot of different ways. Capital itself, that is the ability to invest wealth, to make more wealth, to create jobs, to create enterprises. Capital itself has gotten immensely mobile, as all of us, I think, are aware. Transactions can happen in Paris, be recorded in Chicago in the next 5 seconds, go back to New York, zoom to Hong Kong, the whole thing is done. Nothing, no human beings necessarily need to be involved in it, but a company has just transferred huge amounts of wealth with rapidity that we just could never imagine. It is easier and easier for globally oriented corporations to think supranationally about stuff. Most Fortune 500 companies that I know about in Chicago, for instance, think about themselves as citizens of the world first, citizens of the United States second, citizens of Chicago a distant third. And they are as interested in what's happening on the global markets as they are with any kind of United States policy. This has some human ramifications. It means that in places where we live, we are more likely to get business leadership that has no roots in our community, right? In a place like Chicago, there used to be an identifiable business elite, a group of families, people who owned, developed, made their fortunes from large corporate enterprises, and who had some real ongoing rootedness to Chicago. So the Chicago Symphony and the Art Institute and even some United Way and some charitable enterprises had their imprimatur, and they were constantly involved in civic activities. Most of the time these days, when you're dealing with a Sears or a Montgomery Ward or some of the big banks or other Fortune 500 companies headquartered in a place like Chicago, you're dealing with top management who are in and out of Chicago within a five-year period, right? They are totally mobile people themselves. They are like the capital that they handle, right? They have no roots. I think that has incredible ramifications for those of us who care about place, about community, about rootedness. Why in the world would they ever think about investing? Investing, which is to place your belief in a community. Other kinds of considerations have to take precedent in their decision making. Okay, a lot more can be said about that, but that's one that we might want to get into. There is, I think, a third set of problems around the development of the post-industrial economy that I'm calling, sort of vaguely the devaluation of work. I think that the Holden Winter community, again, did some work around that. There is a kind of, and it's reflected in these 7,000 a year jobs, there is a kind of McDonaldization of work. The proliferation of places where mindless, roboticized labor does what needs to be done. Mindless even in comparison, to the original Ford assembly line, it seems to me. And these are, in fact, where most of the new jobs are being created. They're these kinds of jobs. They're part-time, they're routine, they're low-skill, they're no-brain in character. The workers themselves are unprotected in lots of ways. They move in and out of these jobs. They themselves have no commitment to the enterprise. First in manufacturing, it seemed to me, but then most often in the service sector and in clerical and office work is being de-skilled. That is, the success of redesigning a set of jobs is defined by how much skill you can get out of those jobs. You can de-skill a job, you open it up, the theory is, to more and more people being able to do it. I think that that has profound implications for the way we think about our work. What happens to the pride in work that comes from control over the work processes and over the product? It seems to me that one of the things that happens to people in that kind of work is that you seek your meaning someplace else, right? You work in order to play. Work itself is no longer play. You work in order to get out of work. You work in order to have leisure. And increasingly, you work in order to have things to consume to do your leisure as well. Lots more can be said about that. The last question I want to raise with just a couple of sentences is, it seems to me that it may be that we are in such a new day in terms of the development of our economy that on this 200th anniversary of the Constitution, we ought to be thinking about reconstituting our relationship to the way in which economic life happens in the United States. I'm saying it seems to me clearer and clearer in cities. We haven't even talked about the environment, limits of growth kinds of arguments that I think resonate somewhat to people from the West Coast. In the Pacific Northwest, it seems to me that the dilemmas raised by the shift to a post-industrial economy more and more have public effects on our quality of life, effects on who we are as people, effects on our communities that are out of control. And that therefore they raise for us the challenge to our own public activity. It took us to the 1930s in the United States to recognize that there was some public role in relationship to the economy. That role basically was defined as sort of sweeping up after the failures of the private economy. It still made a clear separation, right, between what was public governmental business and what was private economic business. But the role of the public sector from the New Deal on was to take care of the sort of failures of the economy, the leftovers, whether it's welfare or unemployment or Medicare or Medicaid, needs that were left by the economy after the economy sort of did its job. It may be that we need to follow some of the European nations and some of the reconstituted even third world nations into rethinking a more proactive and citizen-centered public process for thinking about our economic life together. I'm not sure about that. I think that raises lots of questions for all of us. But I sure would be happy to get some feedback on those solutions or other solutions that any of you might have. I want to wrap it up there and see if there are any reactions to any of this stuff. Let me just summarize for you why I'm hopeless. I have just sketched the workings of an economy which is creating new poor people at an increasing rate, which is providing few portals for entry into its functioning, for those poor people especially, which is increasingly blind to the needs of places and communities, and which uses its human elements in ways which resemble automatons more each week, and over which none of us as citizens has the slightest control or authority. Now, it seems to me that that's a litany of problems in the current economy that is at the very least challenging, and depending on our mood and the time of day, possibly hopeless. But I hope not. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Question.
Yeah.
When you talk about the creation of new poverty, you're talking, as I heard you say, you're talking about people who have no skills, and therefore, because of those absence of skills and lack of training, it's difficult, if not impossible, for them to enter the work marketplace. Under devaluation of work, however, you talk about these same people as, you talk about the jobs as low brain, low skill. Okay, there is your first run of the ladder, however, similar to the industrial times of some decades ago.
Well, they go nowhere, though.
Jobs, which people can enter that top run, yeah. That bottom run, you begin working. Maybe the climbing potential is not still there. I guess I didn't understand what you were saying then, because on the one hand, you say people high-skill jobs, and then you start talking about low-skill jobs.
Yeah. Thank you. Let me just clarify a little bit about it, because I think I need to say just a word more about that. Even the low skill, $7,000 a year jobs, are not being created in the places where the concentration of the new underclass is the greatest, right? So even those kinds of McDonald's jobs are not there for those folks. It seems to me, though, to be that another point I think you're pointing to is that the character of those jobs, I would argue, is unlike the character of the job as a laborer at U.S. Steel, right? Where lots of people came in, didn't speak any English. For the last 60 years in Chicago, they would all go down, be laborers in the stockyards, be laborers at the steel mills, and that would be the place where they would learn English, become sort of acculturated into American ways of doing stuff. And gradually you move up, from class two laborer to class three hauler, and up the ladder you go. There's nothing like that sort of ladder of advancement in the kinds of jobs that are these mostly part-time, even somewhat seasonal, on and off, under 7,000 a year kinds of jobs. Those are really unproductive, it seems to me, in terms of getting people into the mainstream of the economy. I think you're right about the contradiction there. I think there's problems both on the job supply side with the nature of those jobs and with the fact that not even those jobs are near the people who need the most. Yeah?
Offer an observation. Your model is the city of America. And as we think of, I agree with your statements so far, but I think it has to be extended, because you will find your control or your command control communication syndrome, also true in Taipei, Hong Kong, Frankfurt, which is the limit of my experience at least.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very much alive there, the same as what you've described here. And the other spot that it's also very much alive is in small town USA. And that same, you're running into the centralization of control issues and the lack of entry jobs. Mm-hmm. Same thing occurs out there too.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just a city.
And you're still dealing with the displacement of people from the agricultural sector in the small towns particularly. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Following on from the gentleman there, I've had to pinch myself to make me realize that I wasn't listening to a talk in the UK because it was typical to the UK.
Sounds exactly the same?
I mean, on a smaller scale, and I think these conditions have accelerated in the last 10 years. Before then, perhaps 20 years ago, slowly, and then the last 10 years they've accelerated. Mm-hmm. That's typical of the UK.
Mm-hmm. I think these are global trends we're talking about here. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
As you talk about the new poor, from what I've read and what I experience, I live in Los Angeles and work in Los Angeles, both with ethnic minority students and in having developed the shelter for homeless women and children. The research that I seem to be getting is that when you talk about the new poor, that there's a tremendous percentage of women, children, and also minority women and children. And there's been an upswing in statistics of more black women and children poor than were 20 years ago, as well as more Hispanic women and children poor than were 20 years ago. And I'm just wondering what you said something about that you didn't think it was minority percentage.
I don't think race causes poverty in that way. I think that the economy is causing this kind of poverty, and that there's a double whammy on black folks and on Latinos. I think the whole question of the feminization of poverty, though, and the problem of single-parent households and all of that is something we need to really think about, too, in relationship to this. Yes?
I just wonder, are there any cities in the world where this is not happening, in any place? And if there are, what can we learn from them?
Help me out.
Zurich.
Okay, kid.
I've worked in that area. I think Switzerland as a country, being a fairly tight country, has a minimal or non-existent underclass. I mean, I worked as an illegal worker in Switzerland, and the portion of that society that was on the bottom rung is very tiny. In fact, then you get into the question of the guest workers from Yugoslavia and all that. The actual Swiss themselves have a pretty homogenous and balanced society.
I think your exception, I would take your exception, it's very, very important. There is a part of the necessary work for the functioning of the Swiss economy that you have to import workers for, and that's an important set of considerations. Yeah, Dan?
No, I'm glad you pointed that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To respond to the idea that there is more now an international community, it seems to me that those who are involved in that international community depend on the success of the international community. And that international community, in turn, depends on the success of the member communities. And finally, the success, for instance, of the United States depends on the success of the cities. And for me, from what I've gotten from what your talk has been about, is that the problem is really the movement from a direct contact with communities to an indirect contact with communities. But that contact is still there. And the problem is, for me, seems to be that moving from direct to indirect we have lost touch with those problems, and that's not an irreversible situation. It's not a hopeless situation. To me, it seems a matter of getting back in touch. It's a matter of awareness, and I'm wondering if that fits into your ideas.
Well, part of what you go ahead.
Haven't we created our own monster back in the 30s and 40s? When we started some social programs that we have, that we encourage people now not to work, we encourage people not to advance, we penalize people in society today by advancing. We penalize people through our entitlement systems for taking jobs. Some way I have people that work for me that can't come off of welfare. I mean, they can't come off of welfare and take, fairly good paying jobs, way over your $7,000, because to do this, they would lose benefits. They would lose child care, they would lose numerous other benefits, quote, that they have coming now. Many of those are what was talked about earlier. They can't have these benefits if they're, quote, married. They can't have these benefits if, quote, there's a male living in the household, or a female living in the household. So I think we've created our own monster.
Well, I think I, in many ways, disagree with you about that. I think that... We really should continue this one, I think. But let me just say briefly in response to that, that it does seem to me that there is very little reason to defend the current structuring of most welfare programs. And I'm not going to defend the current structuring of most welfare programs. I think it's crazy in lots of ways. But I think that even if they were structured well, that there would still be a primary cause of poverty that comes out of the structure of work created by the economy. The problem is there's no jobs there. The problem is basically there's no jobs there. And that seems to me the primary one to work on, not the secondary welfare problems. Although I'm with you on let's try to reform that too.
I think the jobs are there.
Yeah, well, not where I am. Thank you all.